Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you, wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. You know, when we usually think about the human genome, we tend to picture this static, permanent blueprint.
Right, like a fixed schematic.
Exactly. It's the master schematic you're born with. And we often imagine it just, you know, sits there in the nucleus of your cells, unchanging from the day you are born until the day you die.
Yeah, which couldn't be further from the truth.
Right. The reality is just far more dynamic. Instead of a printed blueprint, imagine a massive, incredibly complex audio control board with millions of tiny volume knobs.
I love that analogy.
And over your lifetime, these knobs are constantly being turned up or turned down, changing how your genes behave based on your environment, your age, and your lifestyle.
And, you know, for the longest time, science has essentially viewed those microscopic volume knobs as having just two settings. Basically on or off.
Just a bite.
Exactly. They were either methylated, meaning they had a specific chemical tag attached to them to turn the gene off, or they lacked that tag, leaving the gene on. It was treated as a completely binary system, you know, a simple one or a zero.
But what if there's a hidden third setting?
Yeah.
Like a secret ternary code sitting right there on your DNA that we've mostly just been missing. A subtle modification that tells a really rich, hidden story about how fast your individual tissues are aging, your biological sex, and even your underlying risk for complex systemic diseases.
It's massive.
How could this change our understanding of human aging, and what really happens when we finally read the genome's secret instructions at scale? Today, well, we are taking a deep dive into exactly that.
Unlocking this third setting, I mean, it represents a profound shift in how we understand the very mechanics of human biology.
Today, we celebrate the work of the researchers at the Center for Computational and Genomic Medicine at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, the University of Pennsylvania, and Illumina, who have advanced our understanding of ternary code DNA methylation dynamics associated with human traits.
And, to really fully grasp the magnitude of what this research team has accomplished, I think we should start by looking at the mechanics of epigenetics.
Okay, let's do it.
So those volume knobs on the control board, they're formally known as cytosine modifications. Mm-hmm. And the most famous, well-studied one is 5-methylcytosine.
Or 5-methyl-C, for sure.
Right, 5-methyl-C. When that specific chemical tag is added to the cytosine base of your DNA, it generally acts as a silencer.
It turns the volume down.
Exactly. It physically recruits proteins that compact the DNA, effectively turning the gene's volume down or completely off. And this mechanism is just absolutely crucial for maintaining cellular identity throughout your entire body.
Which, I mean, that makes perfect sense when you think about how a body develops, right? Because a brain cell and a liver cell, they contain the exact same genetic sequence.
Yeah.
The same starting DNA.
The exact same code.
But they have to behave radically differently. And they achieve that because they have distinct epigenetic patterns, right? Like different arrays of 5-millic tags turning different genes off. So the liver cell doesn't accidentally start trying to fire off neurotransmitters like a neuron.
Exactly. And scientists have mapped these silencing patterns for years using epigenome-wide association studies, which we usually just call EWIS.
EWIS, okay.
Yeah, the goal of an EWIS is to look at massive groups of people, sometimes tens of thousands of individuals, to find statistical links between these chemical silencing tags and the onset of various diseases.
Right.
Now, historically, the workhorse tool used to perform this kind of population screening was something called an Infinium array, specifically the EPIC array.
And these arrays are basically microchips, right?
Right. They're essentially microchips dotted with hundreds of thousands of tiny probes that can read epigenetic tags across the genome all at once. And they became the industry standard because they are highly cost-effective and really easy to run on thousands of samples.
But they also had a major blind spot.
A huge one, yeah.
Because those older microchips relied on static, outdated probe designs that just completely missed a wave of recent biochemical discoveries. Specifically, they were missing a slightly different, highly elusive tag called 5-hydroxymethylcytosine.
Or 5-ACNC.
Right, 5-ACNC. And 5-ADNC is that hidden third setting on the control board we've been missing all these years.
Yeah, and the biology of 5-ACNC makes it incredibly difficult to track. I mean, it behaves entirely differently from the standard 5-MANC silencer tag.
How so?
For one, it is incredibly stochastic, meaning It's highly variable and seemingly random.
Yeah.
You might find it at levels under 30% per site, even when you're looking at a group of supposedly identical cells.
Wow, okay.
Furthermore, it doesn't just blanket the genome. It concentrates itself in highly specific, delicate regulatory regions.
I see.
So measuring a chemical signal that subtle and that geographically restricted, it requires intense quantitative resolution. And the old Infinium arrays simply weren't engineered to capture a signal that faint.
Okay, let's unpack this. If modern single-cell whole genome sequencing is the gold standard, because it can see every single base in every single cell, why not just wait for that technology to get cheaper instead of building a new array?
Well, it's a good question. Single-cell sequencing is undeniably an incredible tool. It offers unprecedented resolution.
Right.
However, it remains far too expensive and technically complex for the sheer scale of massive population studies.
Oh, because of the sample sizes needed?
Exactly. Dissecting the origins of a complex disease means analyzing how age, biological sex, genetic background, and a lifetime of environmental exposures all interact.
You need a lot of data for that.
Right. You cannot glean that from sequencing 10 or even 100 people.
Yeah.
You need to analyze tens of thousands of individuals simultaneously to find statistically significant patterns.
Which would bankrupt any lab using single-cell sequencing right now.
Exactly. The scientific field desperately needed a highly focused, scalable bridge between that deep, base-by-base, single-cell biology and cost-effective population screening. And that specific gap is what this new research fills.
So I imagine building that bridge requires a completely new kind of architecture. If the old microchips were physically missing the subtle signals, the team had to design a new array that sees everything without ballooning the cost per sample.
Yeah, and to do that, the team developed a completely novel tool called the Methylation Screening Array, or MSA.
MSA.
And the brilliant part of their approach was aggressive curation. They basically condensed the genome-wide targets down to 284,317 unique probes.
Which sounds like a lot, but I'm guessing it's actually pretty focused.
Yeah, in genomic terms, it's a highly refined VIP list. Half of the MSA design targeted known human trait associations pulled from all those previous EUS studies.
So essentially the greatest hits of epigenetic disease markers.
Yeah. Exactly, the greatest hits. And the other half leveraged the very latest single-cell breakthroughs to identify highly specific cell identity markers. They basically stripped away the biological noise and packed the chip exclusively with the most meaningful regulatory sites.
But upgrading the targets on the microchip is only half the battle, right? You still have to solve the chemistry problem. Like, you still have to be able to physically read that hidden third setting, the 5-HEMC.
Yes. And that brings us to the critical methodological innovation of this study, profiling the ternary code. We are talking about the ability to clearly distinguish between 5-binic, 5-HMC, and standard, unmodified cytosine.
Because the standard chemical process used in older arrays couldn't do that.
Right. The old process is called bisulfite conversion.
Yeah.
And the problem with bisulfite conversion is that it cannot tell the difference between 5-binic and 5-HMC. It just chemically lumps them together into one general category of modification.
Which researchers refer to broadly as 5-HMC. So standard epigenetic tests were basically colorblind, seeing red and pink as just red. But this BACE protocol gives them the glasses to see red, pink, and white as completely distinct biological signals. What did they see when they put those glasses on?
Well, to construct those glasses in the first place, the research team utilized a sophisticated protocol called BACE.
BCE.
Yeah, that acronym stands for Bisulfite Apelbeck-Cupboard Epigenetic Sequencing.
That is quite the acronym.
It is. But the powerhouse of this protocol is an enzyme called APOBEC3A.
Okay, what does it do?
This enzyme essentially strips away a specific chemical component, an amino group, from the regular 5-milic tags. By stripping away that amino group, the enzyme fundamentally changes the physical shape of the molecule.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this process is called deamination. And because the shape is changed, the sequencing machinery reads it as a completely different genetic letter.
That's brilliant.
It is. But here is the magic of APOBIC3A. It leaves the elusive 5-mutability tags completely untouched.
Oh, I see. So by running two parallel experiments on the same sample, one with standard bisulfite and one with this BACE protocol, you can mathematically subtract the signals.
Exactly.
You compare the two readouts, and suddenly those three distinct states emerge accurately on a massive scale. I imagine looking at the genome with those new glasses on must have been jarring. If they can suddenly see 5-ACC clearly, they must have immediately noticed. It's not just randomly scattered around. Like, where was it hiding?
Well, for a long time, because 5-ACTC was so incredibly difficult to measure, its biological role wasn't fully appreciated outside of the brain, where it happens to be quite abundant.
Right.
But this new array conclusively proved that 5-ACTC is highly tissue-specific across the entire human body.
Interesting.
Yeah, when the team analyzed 117 primary human tissue samples, they found 5-HTCC is indeed incredibly abundant in the central nervous system, heavily enriched in neurons.
Okay.
Conversely, it is at its absolute lowest in highly proliferative tissues, places like the colon and the lymph nodes.
Oh, which actually that makes biological sense when you think about how tissues regenerate. Colon cells and lymph node cells are constantly turning over, shedding, and dividing to keep the body healthy.
Exactly. The rapid division is the key. You see, 5-HMLC isn't actively copied by the cell's standard maintenance enzymes during cell division.
Oh, so it just gets lost.
Essentially, yes. When a cell splits into two, the existing 5-HMLC marks are distributed, but not fully replenished. So over multiple cycles of rapid division in tissues like the colon, the 5-HMLC signal simply gets diluted and washes out.
Wow.
Yeah, and what emerges from this mapping is a picture of 5-HMLC and 5-HTC working as opposing yet perfectly complementary forces in defining cell identity.
So the volume knobs are really working in tandem. The researchers noted that 5-HMLC accumulation correlates positively with tissue-specific gene expression. It essentially acts as a fluorescent highlighter on the genome, turning the volume up. Meanwhile, the standard 5-HMLC marks in those same tissues usually suppress expression, turning the volume down. Like, for instance, they found that liver-specific 5-HMLCA tags localize heavily around genes like APOA2.
Which is a gene that is absolutely crucial for proper liver function and cholesterol synthesis.
Exactly. And heart-specific 5-HMLCs localize directly to CACQ2, a gene vital for the mechanical contraction of heart muscle.
It's just a beautifully elegant system of biological regulation.
It really is.
But, you know, if 5-HMLC is acting as a neon sign telling specific tissues exactly how to behave, what happens when those signs start flickering or accumulating abnormally over decades?
Which naturally brings us to how our tissues age, and specifically the mechanics of epigenetic clocks.
Right.
And for anyone who hasn't encountered epigenetic clocks before, they are mathematical models, the Horvath clock being most famous, that look at the methylation patterns on your DNA to predict your biological age. And sometimes your biological age is older or younger than your chronological age, which serves as a massive indicator of your overall health, lifestyle impact, and mortality risk.
Absolutely. And those older, highly relied upon clocks, they were built using data that, as we established earlier, was chemically colorblind.
Because they lumped 5-HMLC and 5-MSEC together.
Exactly. So the research team applied their new array to test 20 of these older epigenetic clocks. And they discovered that those predictive models actually relied heavily on 5-MSEC changes without the original creators ever realizing it.
Here's where it gets really interesting, right? We've been using these epigenetic clocks for years, but we didn't even realize the gears inside were partly driven by 5-MSEC.
Right, because 5-MSEC naturally accumulates as we age. Using the high resolution of the MSA array, the team demonstrated that 5-MSEC profiles alone can predict a person's chronological age with highly impressive accuracy.
It makes me wonder why it builds up in the first place, though. Like, is the cell intentionally turning up the volume on certain genes to compensate for the stress of aging? Or is this just the biological machinery getting sloppy and leaving tags behind over time?
Well, it appears to be a complex mix of both, honestly. As we age, we experience epigenetic drift.
Epigenetic drift, okay.
Yeah, the enzymes responsible for placing and removing these chemical tags lose their youthful efficiency. There's a breakdown in cellular maintenance, leading to an accumulation of 5-HMLC that really reflects the biological wear and tear on the tissue.
So it's basically biological rust.
In a way, yes. And knowing this makes you realize we've been using these epigenetic clocks for years to read the time without understanding how the internal spring of the watch was actually winding.
And if tissues are aging differently and their epigenetic landscapes are shifting over time, diseases must anchor deeply into those specific tissues. Like, you can't just look at a generic blood sample and assume it tells you everything happening in the deep tissues of the brain or the gut.
Exactly. And applying the array to thousands of known trait-associated markers proved exactly that. The researchers demonstrated that disease markers colocalize precisely with the specific tissue that manifests the disease.
Yeah, the probes associated with Alzheimer's disease showed the most extreme, distinct ternary code readings specifically in the brain tissues they profiled.
Right.
And the markers for inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD, peaked exactly where clinical pathology would expect, in the colon and small intestine tissues.
Which is incredible to see so clearly. A genetic variant might increase your overall risk for a disease like diabetes, but this array allows us to see how that variant distinctly alters the epigenetic control board, specifically within pancreatic cells.
It grounds our understanding of systemic disease risk in the actual physical organ it ultimately damages.
Exactly.
But, you know, we've talked about mapping solid tissues like the brain and the gut, but getting a brain biopsy for a routine checkup isn't exactly practical. Clinical medicine relies heavily on blood because it's accessible.
Right, it's a standard blood draw.
Were they able to spot these same delicate, hidden signatures in something as messy and mixed as a whole blood sample?
They were. In fact, tracking the ternary code in blood was one of the most successful applications of the array. The researchers tested 64 whole blood samples spanning different ages and sexes to see if they could track deep, inter-individual immune cell changes over a person's lifespan.
Wow, okay.
Because blood is a complex mixture of many different immune cells, they used the unique epigenetic signatures captured by the array to calculate exactly what types of cells were present in each person's bloodstream.
And what did they find?
They tracked a significant decrease in CD4 plus T cells as people aged.
Oh, those are the immune system's primary helper cells that orchestrate responses to pathogens, right?
Exactly. And simultaneously, they tracked a distinct increase in neutrophils, which are the aggressive first responders to inflammation.
Which perfectly mirrors what we know about inflammaging, that chronic low-grade inflammation that tends to build up in older adults as their immune system shifts.
Yep. They also found some really distinct sex differences in the blood, tracking how immune cell populations differ between males and females.
Like what?
Well, females generally presented with higher proportions of CD8 plus T cells.
The killer T cells.
Right, the ones tasked with directly destroying infected or cancerous cells. And conversely, females had lower proportions of natural killer or NK cells compared to males.
These shifts in cell populations are fundamental to understanding real-world medical mysteries. I mean, they help explain why immune responses to infections differ so drastically between men and women, and why autoimmune disease rates are heavily skewed depending on biological sex.
Absolutely.
So we have this new hyper-focused microarray. We have the BACE protocol letting us finally see the ternary code of DNA in high definition. We know 5-PiXM-EC turns the volume up on tissue-specific genes, acts as a hidden gear in our aging clocks, and tracks perfectly with immune cell degradation. What does this look like when applied to clinical research moving forward?
Well, one of the most immediate and powerful applications of this technology is high-resolution cell-type deconvolution.
Cell-type deconvolution?
Yes, which is exactly what allowed them to track those immune cells in the whole blood samples.
Okay, let's break down cell-type deconvolution. It's essentially like taking a blended fruit smoothie, tasting it, and using a complex chemical recipe key to figure out exactly what precise ratio of strawberries, bananas, and blueberries went into the blender.
And that perfectly encapsulates the process. You extract a bulk tissue sample, like a Sandra vial of blood or a complex piece of a biopsy tumor, and the array reads the epigenetic signature with such high fidelity that an algorithm can calculate the exact percentage of different microscopic cell types swirling around in that sample.
That's wild.
And the MSA was meticulously built using data from deep single-cell sequencing, so it contains the distinct recipe markers for 174 unique cell types, including 82 different highly specialized types of brain cells.
So you no longer need a million-dollar, technically demanding single-cell laboratory setup to figure out what's happening in a patient's tissue. You just run the sample over this cost-effective screening array, and it mathematically unstirs the smoothie for you.
Exactly. The scalability of the MSA allows the entire scientific community to reevaluate massive, highly diverse human populations for disease risk.
Right.
We now possess a much more precise tool to potentially catch subtle microscopic epigenomic shifts, like the earliest flickering of those neon 5-H mini-like C signs, long before clinical symptoms of a disease ever appear in a patient.
It heavily democratizes access to incredibly high-resolution biological data.
It really does.
But as with any major scientific breakthrough, we have to look impartially at the boundaries. What are the limitations of this initial study, and what barriers still need to be crossed?
One significant limitation involves the 117 primary human tissues they profiled. The researchers were working with an anonymous cohort that lacked deep metadata. Yeah, that means they did not have access to detailed medical histories or clinical diagnoses for those specific tissue donors.
Which naturally restricted their ability to directly validate every single trait probe against a confirmed disease state within those exact physical samples.
Correct.
So for the listener, this means the researchers can prove the volume knob was turned up on the control board, but because they used a separate public database for their gene expression comparisons, specifically a database called GTX, they can't prove with 100% certainty that the music actually got louder in that exact same room.
That's a great way to put it. They made a highly educated comparison, but it wasn't a direct observation within the same exact cell.
Right.
The sample size of 117 tissues is also a starting point, not a finish line. To map out the massive subtleties of human biological diversity, future research desperately needs to apply this methylation screening array to vast cohorts containing tens of thousands of diverse individuals.
Of course.
And crucially, as you pointed out with the music room analogy, future studies must run matched gene expression arrays on the exact same physical samples. That is the only way to definitively prove the causal link between ternary code changes and the actual physical regulation of the genes involved in human disease.
It's like we've just been handed the ultimate translation dictionary for a cellular language we've only been pretending to fully understand for the last 10 years. We thought we were reading the whole genome's control board, but we were completely missing an entire dimension of the code.
Exactly. The newly developed methylation screening array allows researchers to read the genome's epigenetic control board with unprecedented clarity and scale, finally distinguishing the critical but elusive 5-micron mark from traditional 5-methyl-C. By uncovering this ternary code of DNA methylation, scientists can now map exactly how our lifestyle, aging, and biology interact to drive disease at a tissue-specific level.
We started out talking about the genome as a dynamic control board, with millions of tiny volume knobs that we mistakenly thought only had an on or off switch. Now we know there's a third setting, hiding in plain sight, dictating how our tissues age and function over a lifetime. What does this mean for the future of personalized medicine when a routine blood test might not just tell you your overall biological age, but reveal exactly which of your individual tissues are aging the fastest? This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base. Found a fire like a locked up door. Later shattered on the lab floor. I scroll through noise, I chase the thread. A truth in pieces misread, misled. So I slow it down, I change the light. Strip the static from the white on white. If meaning's there, it won't stay gone. I keep the pulse till the pulse comes on. Make it readable. Signal that stands, yeah, we're rising through the glitch too.